5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hi, folks. I know what you're thinking. It's the weekend. There's not supposed to be another episode of Soundtracking until Monday. Well, listen, we are the gift that keeps on giving. Welcome along to another episode of Soundtracking with me, Edith Bowman. Wonderful to have you with us. So it has been a busy week. It has been a very, very busy week. I have spoken to so many people about so many different films this week and quite a few legends. I just need to take a moment to tell you about chatting to Erwin Winkler, who is, if you're like, do I know that name? Well, he is a legendary producer and director, actually. And he produced films like all the Rocky films and the Creed films. He produced Raging Bull, Goodfellas, amongst many, many others. And his most recent film is called The Alto Nights. And it stars Robert De Niro playing two roles. These two New York gangsters who grew up together but very much follow different paths and become kind of arch enemies in older life. I don't think I'm not allowed to tell you about it. The embargo's still in place. But I will say I was allowed to post social. So I'll just say I loved it. And I really enjoyed chatting to Barry Levinson and Erwin about the film. So those two are going to be coming in kind of individual podcasts, but celebrating that film. So there we go. But legendary status continues on this latest episode of Soundtracking. It sees a return, a very long return, I've got to say, 8 years since we had Steven Soderbergh on the podcast, who threw me off the first time he came on when he said, oh yeah, I've been listening to your Sofia Coppola episode. I was like, what? And it totally threw me before going into the interview. So anyway, it was nice to get back in the hot seat with him to talk about his new film, spy thriller Black Bag. Cate Blanchett, Michael Fassbender among its excellent cast. Black Bag tells the story of an intelligence agency couple. The husband of the couple is assigned to investigate the wife when she is suspected of something. It's great. It's a lot of fun. It's a really interesting take on the spy thriller genre. It's so beautiful. It's so luxurious. You'll hear us talk about these kind of two key scenes within the film that are based around a dinner party. Incredible drama. Incredibly shot as well. And incredible use of music. Black Bag is scored by friend of the show, the wonderful David Holmes. What a score he's created. And we'll begin with his title track.
Thank you.
congratulations on this film.
Oh, thanks.
I had so much fun with it. It's a real kind of visceral, kind of come out tapping almost in a way. It's got a real beautiful rhythm to it as well.
Oh, good.
And I want more.
We know what to do with it, but
yeah?
First, people have got to show up. And we don't want to jinx it, but no. One day, Kep said, well, you know what I think happens. And he told me, and I go, that's really interesting.
So. Where did this this journey start with these characters and this kind of, this landscape of this world, really, I guess?
David, Kep and I have known each other since 1989, so it's been a long friendship. And so I've known about his desire to write this for a while. It's been a couple decades.
Wow.
He came out of working on the first Mission Impossible feeling there was an interesting movie to be made, kind of like what this ended up to be.
Yeah.
But couldn't quite, I don't know, never quite had the time or never sat down and really did it. When he and I started working together, we started talking about it a little bit. And I expressed my hope that what he was describing would have aspects that felt a little like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And that ended up being represented a little bit by the marriage. They don't attack each other like George and Martha do.
Yeah.
But the idea of a dinner drinks thing gone wrong, epically wrong, was something we talked about.
Yeah.
I remember him telling me, you know, I finished the first dinner table sequence. It's 12 pages.
Amazing. Well, I could have almost like sat and had an entire meal with them. The way that you kind of immerse us in that environment where we feel like we're kind of eavesdropping in on this absolutely phenomenal kind of setup. We just get to luxuriate in it, you know, both
right.
in terms of the way that it's shot and the location and the kind of energy and the kind of build of that kind of tension as it
right.
goes on. It's just captivating. It really...
Well,
really
I mean,
wonderful.
The two dinner sequences are the action passages in our movie. That's our car chase. And so I have to think of it like that, directorially.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things I loved about the film. One of the many things is the fact that it kind of goes against the expectation of what you think a kind of spy thriller is going to be in terms of that, what you just mentioned, that kind of physical action that's there. And this is almost mental action in a way.
Yeah.
And it's kind of sexier. It's kind of more immersive. You're kind of, I don't know, you're more invested in it in a way as well, in terms of how much can he get out? How much can they drag out?
Right.
How much are they going to reveal in a way as well?
That's always the challenge with stories like this, is how you release information, when you release information, and through whom and to whom you release this information.
Mm.
We had to go back and do a little bit of recalibrating because we found, you know, some clarity issues for the audience around who knows what, when.
Yeah.
And you really don't want them asking those questions. And so David and I went back and did some very targeted work to make clear what the motivations are or what you ought to think the motivations are at that point. That's the fun part,
yeah.
You know, is kind of figuring it out. But I knew I had everything I needed.
With these performances as well, how much of that navigated, if anything, needed to shift? Because, I mean, the casting in this is exceptional, and especially around that dinner table, you know, in terms of kind of these different characters and
yeah.
the performances from these actors with this. That's got to, for you, give you more than, obviously it's on the page, you know, they're bringing it to life. They are responding in a way, verbally, non-verbally in a way as well. And what's the kind of dance that you do around that, and how many times you shoot it, how many variations you give yourself on that particular type of thing?
Well, I'm trying to sort of create a spell that we're all under.
Yeah.
And me too. And then not break it by calling attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
So in the same way that an actor may come to me and propose something,
mm-hmm.
and I may say, no, I don't think that works, and here's why. I sometimes come on to set with an idea, and the thing says to me, that's not going to work
yeah.
for me, and I have to recalibrate. So I go through a process of having to surrender also. But the key to me is to try and get move this thing into a sort of flow state and let that happen. One of the easiest ways to disrupt that is to start running your mouth. And so it's easy for me to imagine that somebody who's worked with me before would talk to somebody who hasn't worked with me before and just prepare them like, yeah. He's not going to talk a lot.
Okay.
You know, and that's true. I really try to keep my comments to practical things,
yeah.
You know, to keep it physical and not get chatty.
Yeah. The way the film starts as well, it's kind of like there's a rhythm there with the drums and that kind of like the beats there. And we have this absolutely stunning kind of track shot of kind of Michael going in and coming back out again
right.
at this venue. It's fantastic. You know, in terms of that as an introduction piece, you know, in terms of we're here, we're in this
right.
world, we're with this character, we're over his shoulder and we're kind of like, you're immediately kind of looking and listening and watching for things as well. You know, when you're working out the script and what you're going to shoot, that's such an important part of the journey for the audience. Is it sometimes the hardest bit to get right or to work out what that's going to be? Or was that how it was written and
no,
how
that's
you envisioned
a reshoot.
It? Wow.
The first version of the scene was the two of them on a bench by the Thames. And before we were even done shooting, I felt that's not enough. And I pitched David the idea, since the subject of the part of the subject of the meet is this infidelity thing, he should be fishing him out of a club he wouldn't go to in a million years. That's what the scene should be. And David's like, I love that.
Yeah.
The shot itself evolved out of a combination of the reality. I didn't go in thinking, like, I want to do a Goodfellas ripoff.
Yeah.
I went into it with a location that presented specific challenges.
Yeah.
Both exterior and interior. I want to give Michael a real reveal. I have to wait until it's dark, which is late at this point of the year. I have 3 hours to shoot all of it. Everything, the whole thing. Inside, out, everything. We have 3 hours, 9 to 12. That's all they will give us. So we've got to do the Steadicam shot within an hour, and then I have 2 hours to do the scene proper outside.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're cranking, like trying to get through this and trying to get out before they're like, we're going to open the club and you won't be able to control any of this. So the simplicity of how that's approached, and as it turns out, doing it in one shot was the simplest way to do it, in addition to serving this idea of having a reveal
yeah.
of Michael and thematically aligning with what the scene is about. So that's just, again, filtering possibilities down to it wants to be this.
Yeah. And we see a little cameo of Mr. Holmes
yes,
in that
do.
Club
we,
as well.
We brought him in for that. I thought it was appropriate.
David, you've got an hour to get this right.
Yeah.
Make sure you don't
yeah.
cock it up.
Yeah, totally. Well, that's in his blood, so that was...
The music's fantastic.
Yeah.
And it really, really is. And what's really lovely is I read a really nice kind of quote about either yourself or David said about espionage, about the idea of it being kind of really ambiguous. You know, that world of espionage. And I kind of like how you almost kind of assume that when you hear the music that it's going to go one way, but there are times within the film where it kind of surprises you and kind of leads off in a slightly different direction.
Yeah.
So brilliant. What did you have in your mind about what the music was going to be?
Well, the first approach we ended up throwing out, the first thing I asked for, which was a much more romantic, traditionally romantic kind of sound. And it didn't work. Like, it just didn't work. David always gives me stuff early.
Yeah.
So I have it while I'm shooting. And it just didn't work. It was not, even though I was trying to create this high gloss kind of Hollywood aesthetic. And you would think music that sounds adjacent to that would work with it. It just didn't. And it was obvious. And so I said, okay, I want you to go back and work on something that's a little more propulsive and a little less romantic.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent me a bucket of stuff, and it's all in the movie. So, you know, that happens. Sometimes you ask for the wrong thing, and all you can do is say that and talk about what might be the right thing. I still am embarrassed to admit that I know nothing about how he does what he does on a technical, practical level. Mm-hmm. I don't know what his setup is over there. I don't know who the people are that he brings in. I don't know what he's charged to rent the space. I ought to know more, and I know nothing. He just, you know, generates material mm-hmm. and is extremely responsive. And so he might send me a cue, and I go, it's great. I need it. I need it to be 8 bars longer. And could you do a variation that's arranged with these instruments, mm-hmm. you know, at a slightly higher BPM? Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, those are the conversations we start to have. I'm sending him the cut constantly so he can see what's happening.
He's responding to that. And I think as well, the whole kind of aesthetic of the film, the production design, that house that they live in, you know, as well, that's, it's such a character. And we get those little moments as well of kind of diegetic music. So you've got Squeeze in the pub. What are those telling us? What are those, or are those just kind of incidental? Or are they...
They're a combination of trying to give you some insight into, in that case, what kind of pub it is and what kind of clientele
yeah.
it's trying to attract. And my yeah. being a fan
love of Squeeze and Elvis Costello.
Squeeze. Yeah. So everybody wins in that context. I never thought it would happen with me and the girl from Clapham. Out on the windy common, that night I ain't forgotten. When she dealt out the rations with some of the passions, I said, you are a lady. Perhaps she said, I may be. We moved into a basement with thoughts of our engagement. We stayed in by the telly, though the room was smelly. We spent our time just kissing, the railways were missing. But love had got us hooked up. The entire first dinner table scene is comprised of 3 songs, all from a playlist that Michael's wife, Alicia, generated. I asked Michael, I said, when you guys throw a dinner party
yeah.
at home, who does
who's
the
in
playlist?
Charge of music, yeah.
And he goes, she does. And I go, will you have her send me one of her, like, guests for dinner playlists, and I picked 3 songs off that list, and she has a credit under the special thanks, DJ Vicarious.
That's so cool.
Yeah, they were perfect. It's on them. I think of the scene, I really associate it with the sound that each of those has, those songs, at that moment in the scene.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
I love that.
She's well, got very
good.
She's got a really good taste.
Good
it was a great playlist.
Hard to choose just 3 songs from
yeah.
it, for sure. There's a couple of cues in particular I wanted to talk about, if you don't mind as well. Just one of the lake scenes, and there's this amazing kind of double bass,
yeah.
kind of heavy kind of moment as well, which is so great.
With, and this was a late addition, a military snare.
Wow.
And a sort of piano chord hit that's very like Jerry Goldsmith, 7 Days in May kind of thing.
Yeah.
That David developed late. And I was like, oh, I really like the sound of that.
Yeah.
I never would have asked for it. Like, you should get a military snare. But he kind of picked up on that 7 Days in May thing and how that might work here.
The rhythm that is the kind of constant with different drum instrumentation, I guess, as well. You've got that tom moment as well, where that's where it's just drums. And I don't know. I don't know the names of the drums.
I don't either.
I think it's a tom drum. I don't know. Yeah. Might be Dave. But it's that idea that it's kind of the rhythm and the drums are the kind of the propulsion in a way of the film.
No, it sounds like an obvious thing to say, but one of the things that was not working about that sort of romantic approach that I asked David to take was it didn't have a clock.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just, I realized you need to feel the clock like all the time. It should be like a heartbeat. You're aware of things moving a little faster than the characters wish they were moving.
It's almost his kind of adrenaline.
Yeah, no, it is. It's he's getting
a kick, he gets out.
Spike, and you should feel that.
Yeah. Talking about that spike, the polygraph section, it's so great.
It's again great scene on paper. It's my job to kind of visually come up with a scheme, you know, to keep it funny.
Yeah,
you know, because if you don't get the laughs that are there, then you've really made a mistake. So it's a real, in the times I've seen it, like in previews, that's a real crowd pleaser scene.
Yeah.
They love her.
Marissa is amazing.
They love her.
In this entire film, I mean,
it's a great part.
Oh, it's so
she
great.
She and Tom
make
a great, like, screwed up couple. They really do.
They could have a spin-off.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. What was the kind of thought around how you would score that particular? Because it's interesting, but we don't really see George asking the questions. In that it's more about their reaction to the question and then their response to it as well. And the way you've chosen to kind of shoot that as well and the different angles is really kind of clever and slightly contorted in some ways in terms of the way they respond. It's brilliant. Was that a bit of a journey in terms of how you wanted that to sound with the score and stuff as well? What you would have under
that? Well, that's a scene where you really, it's all or nothing. And I decided to go with nothing.
Yeah.
That like, I'll just do the sound of the fans operating all the equipment and Michael's voice, because it's like an 8 minute scene and it's kind of running at a certain pace. So if you were going to attempt to score that, you know, there's not a lot of room, you know, for you to roll up. You'd have to use it in such a way that it would become distracting.
Yeah.
You know, usually you're trying to use the score as a way of rearranging the molecules and the viewer's reaction to what they're looking at. But sometimes, like in a scene like that, there it's kind of going like this. And so it's not at the first dinner table scene has multiple kind of peaks and waves. You know, you're like on a 20-foot wave, like, you know what I mean? Yeah, it's like that. And then it like goes down again and then it comes up. And so that's easier to sort of use music to indicate to the audience a tilt. But, you know, the goal is to have it really transform the images in a way that creates a kind of third thing that neither the music or the images are on their own. There's some alchemy, and that's usually not having the music do what the images are doing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like my first blush is always, okay, well, what if I go hard? What if I do a hard 180? Does that work? Sometimes.
Yeah.
Using a fast tempo piece against something slow or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, it really was a way to keep the audience aware of, like I said, how kind of behind the characters feel all the time.
Do you think, because I heard that it was originally written in this for the States and you relocated it to London. Do you think the music would have been different had it been set in the States?
I think it's very likely, because different images throw off kind of different notions of how they should be accompanied.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So
totally.
If I were shooting this in like DC and Arlington, I don't know if that score feels right there.
Mm-hmm.
We'll never know.
Oh, will we?
But it seemed to, I don't analyze those decisions very much of like, who do I want to call? It's a very short list of people that I call.
Yeah.
And it's usually just total instinct.
The other thing, weird, it's such a bizarre thing to ask about, but it's particularly with Michael, is walking. One of the things as well that really stood out was like how much time you give things. And I love that it's not about quickly get to the next thing. It's like we have time as an audience to kind of sit with the situation, where they're going, where they've come from.
Right.
What that journey is, whether that's straight from the opening or even when he's walking down the corridor to kind of give her pass back, you know, or even driving down the motorway to the airport. Those little moments where we just get a little bit of time to exist in that situation.
Yeah.
I don't really know what the question is around that, but I love that you give us that as an audience.
Well, I feel the fact it's so easy to manipulate time to your benefit as a filmmaker through editing means that you shouldn't all the time, and that you should carve out just little opportunities to both orient the character in an actual physical space that the audience sort of believes and has some real orientation with. And the fact that certain things will always take a certain amount of time, like walking from there to there, and that roots you somehow in the world as it gets crazier and crazier. I like it in other movies. I mean, there is a term of art, shoe leather.
Is that a term?
Yeah, where people go, that's shoe leather. And sometimes I feel that way. I'll go like, that's shoe leather. And then sometimes I feel like, no, this is additive to the gestalt of the whole thing for some reason that I can't articulate. But here's the compromise. It'll only be two-thirds as long as it is now. I'll be aggressive about the top and the tail.
Yeah.
But I want to retain a sense of real time for just a few minutes.
Because there's a lot to think about in the film in terms of you, the audience, are trying to work out what's going on, who's done what, who's the guilty party, who's done this. It kind of almost puts you in the mind of the character that you're in that situation with to kind of go, what are they thinking?
Right.
So it gives you that moment to kind of like, think, which is really nice thing to do because it immerses you even further into the experience of watching the film. It's great.
Well, I love hanging on characters who aren't talking.
Yeah.
Like, that's really fun, you know? And this movie really provides an opportunity to indulge in that.
Yeah.
You know, because there is a lot of lying going on.
Yeah.
That was, like I said, the biggest thing that kind of, every project should have something that keeps you up at night. Mm. This was obviously these two set pieces that have to be like the audience's favorite scenes in the film. Mm. And it's six people who don't move, you know, just talking. That's not, nobody who writes screenplays is encouraged to do that.
Yeah.
Hey, have your whole movie rest on these two long, static dialogue sequences. That's a real recipe to get a green light.
Yeah.
You know, but it turns out when it's as good as that as David's script and you can get that cast, then you have people wanting to say yes. What was interesting in this situation, because it was one of those, we took the project out, we had the group, and we went out with it to buyers. None of the streamers were interested.
Wow.
The people that were still in the theatrical business were excited about it. None of the streamers wanted it. Yeah, didn't even ask, like, how much?
Why do you think that is?
I thought, wow, that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. No idea.
Yeah.
In your face, because it's absolutely awesome.
Well, it was pretty definitive, but the good news was we had...
We get on the big screen.
Yeah, we had excited people on the other end of the spectrum, but I wish I knew more about why.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. With you having David in that scene, I always wonder with those scenes as well, when you've got people dancing in club scenes and, you know, normally the music isn't the music that's in the film sort of thing. Did you actually get him to DJ at that point?
Yeah, because of the nature of the shot,
yeah,
I felt it was important that we get a production recording, including with a multi-directional mic attached, to the Steadicam, of what that really sounded and felt like to come in, go down, go back up, so that's a live recording from a microphone attached to the camera.
Because it did kind of is that hypnotic thing of like when you are in that kind of environment and you can kind of just hear what's going on downstairs and it's enticing,
yeah.
In terms of when you, I want to go and dance, I want to go down there. And so you have that in the film where you're kind of.
Well, and even people vocalizing during all of that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The ability to tell everybody. You can talk, but you've got to yell loud enough to be over. The music's loud.
Yeah.
And just that whole, there's a feeling that can be conjured with not a lot of expense that I think is really, has a real effect on the audience.
Yeah.
Sound is often abused, but often really underutilized in the sense that it's shocking how easy it is using very simple elements to put the audience in, create an atmosphere and put the audience right in a space. So it's something I think about a lot.
The whole cast are great in this, but Michael is extraordinary in this. There's just this.
You like the glasses.
I love glasses. Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But he's got there's such a physical performance, as well as such a considered performance. And it's really testament to when you see that moment where kind of the shit's kind of hitting the fan and he's in that room with everybody and you can kind of just see him looking at the desk and you suddenly see a different side to him that you've not seen sort of thing.
Yeah.
That must be almost kind of harder for an actor to kind of contain so much in a performance.
We talked about that scene specifically
because
he was very concerned he was overdoing it. And I go, Michael, for this guy, this is the equivalent of like Jack Nicholson's monologue in Carnal Knowledge. This is as big
as
you get, literally, in the whole movie. And for the rest of it, you can completely squeeze it. But I really need you, because of the way I've set this up and the way the shots are set up, I kind of need you to like freak out a little bit. And he's like, okay.
Yeah. It's that and the little splash on the shirt or the two moments.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Where he almost loses his shit. It's hilarious.
But, Michael's got the range where he can do the maximalist version of a character and he can do the absolute sort of Japanese line drawing.
Yeah.
And that's what I needed to hear, was like, wow, two strokes at the most. He's that sort of controlled, But if it's Michael, you see everything behind it. Mm. It doesn't look opaque.
No.
It just looks still, which is different in the way that a cat is still.
Yeah.
You know?
It's like that lake.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, as soon as you ripple
it. That wonderful little man-made lake.
Is it?
Yes.
You made it specially?
Well, no, somebody else did
somebody
a long time
ago.
But it meant that we could control it and it wasn't a nightmare.
Amazing. And listen, I could talk to you for hours about this film. I thoroughly enjoyed
it.
They
won't let us.
And I know, I'm being literally dragged out. But I can't wait for more. I really hope there is more. It's brilliant. And David's, your collaboration is once again pristine.
Yeah, very happy.
Thanks, Stephen. Cheers.
Good to see you.
You too. Thank you. From The Score to Black Bag, that's Feet First by David Holmes, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrackin' with Steven Soderbergh. Now, David's been a guest on Soundtrackin' in the past, so we thought we'd share a wee clip of him talking about working with Steven. All the music in those films, I mean, they would still be entertaining, but in no way to the level that they are. And I hope
you
take
a
minute to sort of appreciate that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't thought of it like that before because I just think, you know, I just try to do the best job I can. And then that's why I still work with Steven, because as a director, you have to wear every single hat. So you want to know that people that, you know, the heads of department, as it were, that is working for a director, any director, you want to think that they're giving you as much as they're given to the project. And that's all I ever try to do, because I think that's like a working class sort of ethic, you know, like you're given an opportunity and you don't try not to fuck it up.
Yeah.
And I think that I've never took that for granted, because Steven, you know, working for him, especially him, it's sort of, allows you the freedom to go and do, like, produce a band that have absolutely no money, which I'm doing at the minute. Like, I've done it before. I've done it a few times. But I could never do that if I hadn't, you know, working for Steven, because it kind of just gives you a breather to be able to go, okay, let's do something, or let's do, like, a really small budget, or, you know, produce someone, or, you know. So I love all aspects of what I do. Probably because of the way my brain is wired, like the obsessional thing. So I can, you know, I like having a few projects going at the same time, because when you stop working on one and you jump into another, when I'm in that other one, all I'm doing is giving it that 100% attention. So when I come back to the other one, I have a real clear perspective. It's much more objective, you know, rather than like, yeah, sometimes you just can't see the woods for the trees. So when you step back from that, it really actually helps the other projects, because you're just not fixed to it all the time. And it remains fresh in your mind, you know, so that's a real positive, you know. Yeah. But Soderbergh is, it's amazing, you know, we've never actually went out and, hey, I'm in town, do you want to grab a drink or anything like that? You know, we're friends, but in a very unique way, you know. Yeah. And so when he asked me to do something, I'm just like, I'll start tonight.
Start sending him playlists. He loves, like, you could see his face lighting up when he was kind of almost like recollecting, like, just the constant music that you would send him, like, and stuff that he'd never heard of. And he's like, where does he find this stuff? It's like, he's just this amazing kind of like encyclopedia of music that he just like throws up things that you didn't even know that you needed. But as soon as you hear it, you're like, I needed that.
Yeah, no, that's lovely to hear. When I do like any project, even though I've got like, you know, tons of records and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, music was always first in my life before any form of career or anything like that. Doing it for a living allows you the luxury, you know, buying records is what I do. You know, so to me, that's just like, whoa, I never want to lose this.
Yeah.
So if I have a thing, I will go and do loads of research. I mean, I have a massive record collection. Of course I do. But I still, if I have a certain project that's got a certain style or just the director has a certain vision, I'll do a lot of research as well. And sometimes my record collection, it's all there for me. But sometimes you just have to go and, you know, dig even deeper. But that's so exciting to do because it's music that I love. Like I've got a theory, which is only send them music that you love. And then no matter what they choose, it'll be something that you love.
Yeah.
You know, and then you have to respect the director, where he's thinking. But I have such a shorthand with Stephen now where he can just say, this is the ballpark. You know, we don't even discuss the script. He just trusts that I read the script and then I understand the story. And then he says, this is your ballpark. That ballpark, I got to sort of like unpack in loads of different ways, you know? So it's like, okay, I have to imagine this ballpark emotionally. How can I turn this into several different emotions? And with excitement and, you know, all of that. So, because, you know, the films just have a trajectory of lots of different moments that turn into sequences that are emotionally all different. So some of my favorite work I've done without seeing the film. So, you know, you read the script, you talk to the director, and then you imagine what the score is or the, you know, for songs, and then you just do a bunch and then give it over and it all works. And I'm like, that's so good, because if I was working and I'm watching the picture all the time, that's going to affect what the music's like. So you're doing it. It's just a different way of doing it. At the end of the day, what you're imagining is a world that's littered with different emotions.
That was David Holmes talking about working with Steven Soderbergh in an interview you can find wherever you get your podcasts. You just got to search for Soundtracking with Edith Bowman. My huge thanks to Steven for taking the time to talk to us. Black Bag is on general release now and has all the visual style and flair that we've come to expect from Steven's film. So get yourself out there and see it on the big screen. Now, as well as all the usual platforms, you can find my previous conversation with Stephen at edithbowman.com, as well as every single other episode of this podcast, which is fast approaching 500. Follow us on your socials. We are at Soundtracking UK. And please do subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is Soundtracking Extra. Just a little quick thing that I'm looking forward to sharing with you. Adolescence is a new 4-part TV show that is on Netflix now. It has been co-written by Stephen Graham and Jack Thorne. It's directed by Philip Barantini, who worked with Stephen on Boiling Point, both the film and the TV show. Philip and Stephen joined me on the podcast, which I recorded earlier this week. And what was really lovely was became apparent that we got talking about growing up watching films. And Stephen cited 3 films that his dad got from the video shop when he was little, about 14, when he said acting was what he wanted to do. Those films were The Godfather, Taxi Driver and The Deer Hunter. And I was like, hold on a minute, you've worked with De Niro, have you not told him? And he hadn't. But the very next night, he was due to appear on the One Show with De Niro, and he told him. It was so great. So I love that we encouraged that. Next up, though, Paul Dugdale, the director, and Hans Zimmer join me to discuss their film Hans Zimmer and Friends: Diamonds in the Desert. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.